So you would take your Bible and turn to Luke chapter 4. Luke chapter 4. And if you're here last week, you remember last week was part 1. This is part 2. So if you weren't here last week, we'll have just a moment to kind of tie the two together. So you don't need to get up and leave. Luke chapter 4. And what I'd like to do, because we're tying those two together, is begin reading in verse number 14. So this would include our reading for last week as well as what we have for this week. So beginning in verse number 14, Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit to Galilee, and news about him spread throughout the whole countryside. He taught in their synagogues and was praised by everyone. Jesus went to Nazareth, where he had been raised, and on the Sabbath he went to the synagogue as he normally did and stood up to read. The synagogue assistant gave him the scroll from the prophet Isaiah. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me. He has sent me to preach good news to the poor, to proclaim release to the prisoners and recovery of sight to the blind, to liberate the oppressed, and to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." He rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the synagogue assistant, and sat down. And every eye in the synagogue was fixed on him. He began to explain to them, "Today this scripture has been fulfilled just as you heard it." Everyone was raving about Jesus. So impressed were they by the gracious words flowing from his lips. They said, "This is Joseph's son, isn't it?" Then Jesus said to them, "Undoubtedly you will quote this saying to me, 'Doctor, heal yourself. Do here in your hometown what we've heard you did in Capernaum.'" He said, "I assure you that no prophet is welcome in the prophet's hometown. And I can assure you that there were many widows in Israel during Elijah's time, when it didn't rain for 3.5 years, and there was a great food shortage in the land. Yet Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to the widow in the city of Zarephath in the region of Sidon. There were also many persons with skin diseases in Israel during the time of the prophet Elisha, but none of them were cleansed. Instead, Naaman the Syrian was cleansed." When they heard this, everyone in the synagogue was filled with anger. They rose up and ran him out of town. They led him to the crest of the hill on which their town had been built, so that they could throw him off the cliff. But he passed through the crowd and went on his way. So in keeping with kind of where we were last week, here's how I would like to begin. If the temple, and so churches, become the place where people consolidate or isolate the presence of God, then Jesus becomes the idol we use to maintain that vision. Or, put another way, when we identify Jesus as exclusively for us in this church, for instance, we make of him little more than a regional idol who is for us. And so as a prophet, under the power of the Spirit, Jesus shatters this sort of self-addiction, this sort of vision. So last week, we, as mentioned, we began in verse number 14. And so in order to kind of tie these two together and hopefully make the connection, let me give a very, very quick recap, if I may. And by the way, I went back and listened. And you know, we should never listen to what we said last week, because it was like, "Oh, I wished I had said it this way." Or, "Oh, I said it was Samuel when it should have been Nathan." So I want you to know, a few of you listen, because I had a young man catch me after breakfast yesterday morning and said, "I have some questions about last Sunday." Good questions. Important questions. And so I know that we are always open to the possibility of mistake. You already knew that though, right? just making sure. So we titled the beginning of, that is, of this 2 weeks, When the Spirit is Upon Us. Because when we come to read the Scriptures and we experience or encounter Jesus in some form, fashion, some episode, some incident, we are often looking to see in what way does this experience translate into something that ought to form, shape, mold us, or is there some practice or habit that we ought to emulate, something that we ought to do? And so, very quickly, we distinguish the fact that Luke, more than any other gospel writer, plays up the influence of the Spirit upon Jesus. And so, beginning in verse 1 of chapter 4, Jesus was full of the Holy Spirit as he went out to be tempted. In verse 14, when he returned to Galilee in the power of the Spirit. And then when he quoted from Isaiah chapter 61, he said, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me." So Jesus is full of the Spirit, he's in the power of the Spirit, and he's under the influence and leadership of the Spirit. And we want to know, how is it that Jesus executed his mission in the way he did? It was because of the presence and the influence of the Spirit of God upon him. And so if we are want to say, how is it that that might translate for us? One of the implications is, we ought to see how God might be filling us with His Spirit, what the power of that might look like in our lives, and how we might be under the leadership of the Spirit. So that in our very living of our lives, we might find ourselves continuing the mission that God gave Jesus, that He then translated or transferred to the disciples in John 17, which by virtue of our being participants in those that were to come, falls to us. So when we wonder how is it we will carry on the ministry of Jesus, it ought to be by the pattern of Jesus. How is it that we're full of the Spirit? How do we understand the power of the Spirit? And what is it to be under the leadership of the Spirit? And remember, we remarked quickly and somewhat nervously, humorously, that we Baptists have trouble with spirit talk because something might break out. But maybe we ought to pay attention to kind of how that worked out in Jesus' life and maybe how we ought to look for it in our very own. And so what we described was, how did the religious atmosphere get to where it was by the time you get Jesus standing up in the synagogue? And we reminded ourselves of the history of the establishment of the temple. That in the same way Israel asked for a king, the king decided he wanted to build a temple. Now, lest you think that all of a sudden this was just some sort of discovery, this is some kind of experience that that David had, that he wanted to build a temple. Remember, David had been extending the boundaries of the kingdom, which meant he was responsible for vacating the power of other peoples. And so when he did so, he often encountered temples where other gods were worshipped. Right? So when he encountered those spaces, it was like, well, how come, or maybe he was thinking, how come Yahweh doesn't have a temple? And so he determined to build a temple. And then Nathan thought it was a good idea. The prophet there, he conferred with him. And then Nathan said, you've got to tell David he can't do it. And remember, we had a question about this, right? Laura, didn't we have a question about that? Like, where is it that it really states why it is that David couldn't build the temple? And what did we conclude, Laura? Did we find any good answer for that? No, go back and read the text. There's really not a good statement that says, David, you can't build a temple for this reason. We have inserted the reason. Go back and read them. There is not, what we have always said was, is because he was a warring king, and because blood was on his hands, he wasn't going to be the one to get to build the temple. Some want to infer that because of his instance of indiscretion with Bathsheba and then his decision to have Uriah killed, that might have been it. But if you read the Old Testament texts where this experience is told about, there is no stated statement from God, why not David? But Solomon gets to build the temple. Solomon builds a temple that is as extravagant as the palace. All of its appointments and its accoutrements and everything about it was splendid. It was only the best for Yahweh. Now remember, in the conversation Nathan had with God, God said, I don't need a temple. I have been with this people always. And so we reminded ourselves of the fact that when the people stopped as they were traveling through the desert to set up camp for rest, they also set up the tabernacle. It was the place where they practiced their worship. It's the place where they recognized God as God and they practiced their religious habits and rituals. And remember, it was the tabernacle that represented the presence of God, but it was also the clouds and the pillar of fire. Remember, it was also the cloud that hovered over the tent of meeting, in which at which Moses would enter in from time to time. And so as they were traveling, God was traveling with them. The vision was God was always with his people. Now, as people might always not recognize that, they might not always fall under the leadership of the presence of God. They might not always do the things God wanted them to do, but God was always present with the people of God. He didn't need a structure or a building. But when they build a temple, it becomes the place where now they can say God is there. And so they would go up to the temple to meet God, and his presence was there. And so they were consolidating all of their religious energy into that one place. And remember, we tried to say that there sometimes are some parallels. Sometimes how we treat the church. God is only here. So we go to church to meet God because he might not be elsewhere. It's always a risk. It's always a trap. And so when you get to Luke chapter 4, the temple was kind of the center where the conservatives were running the show. And conserve means, you know, nothing changes. You do know that's what that means, right? And the Sadducees could not embrace the idea of resurrection, which was a new idea. They were going to conserve the old way. And so they kind of had rule over the temple. And the Pharisees, they were the ones who believed in resurrection, and they were really more interested in the common person, the average Joe and Jane, remember? And so they tended to dominate the synagogues. And there was one temple and many synagogues. So they had this influence that was nearly all over the area. And so when they were teaching about resurrection. And so they always kind of had this against the other. It was kind of oppositional. The Pharisees were trying to, if you want to talk about church history, they were the Puritans. They were wanting to purify from the errors of the Sadducees. And so they were saying, we need to adhere to this strict understanding of the law and embrace resurrection. And so they were always, remember, pointing out the ways in which Jesus was breaking what? The Sabbath, for sure, right? How come you're healing on the Sabbath? Your disciples are eating on, they're harvesting on the Sabbath. And they were straining at some of these illustrations, right? And so you had this kind of oppositional religious atmosphere. And all the while, the people were accustomed to hearing a promise. Something's going to change. Something's going to be different. Things are going to be set right. And so they would read Isaiah 61, and they would read Isaiah 68, and they had this internal longing that one day God will fulfill the promise, and there would be one who the Spirit of the Lord was on, and he would declare once and for all the newness that would come, that those who had been captive to poverty and to blindness, and if you go read it, it's an expansive in Isaiah 61. In other words, there are a few things not Jesus doesn't include. It's not because they aren't important, but he kind of consolidates the image in Isaiah 61 in those early verses, and he presents it succinctly and says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me to declare good news to the poor, sight for the blind, release for the oppressed, and that this is the day of the Lord. And they understood that. They understood there was this longing, this, I can't wait for things to be different. I can't wait. No more oppressive Romans. So when Jesus stood to speak and read from the Isaiah scroll and he chose that passage, those words, not just because they were the words from Jesus, but those words were very soothing. They were very welcome words. So you're telling me that the one thing we've longed for now has come to pass. And it's today. And that's a very quick recap of what we did last week. And so we find the crowds, in, as we begin this week, they're raving about Jesus. They're impressed by His words. They're gracious words. They're the kinds of words that are endearing. They're the kinds of words that they're just overly excited about. They have heard for themselves what He had done elsewhere, what He had done in Capernaum, what He had done in Galilee, and they really were excited about the possibilities that the prophet has come home. Now, I mentioned last week they would see how quickly it would go from them raving and impressed by Jesus to be angered and wanting to kill Jesus. It just takes a few verses. And so when your vision is that all you can hear is the cavalry has come over the hill to save you and they're going to do these great things among you, to hear the prophet's words, put it in balance. It wasn't that Jesus wasn't the promised one, the one to come. It wasn't that He wasn't Messiah. But when He picked up and self-identified, He picked a different vision. He picked the vision of a prophet. In fact, if you read back to the descriptions in those birth narratives, chapter 1 and 2 of Luke, you already get the announcement of the kind of thing that Jesus is going to do. He's going to be a disruptive force for the way things have been. He's going to bring something new. He's going to cause the rising and falling of many. There's something about the coming of Jesus that everyone thinks He's coming to save a particular vision. That is their vision of how it ought to go. And instead, because He comes and announces something new, He's actually undermining their vision. Now, if I promised you one thing, or you believed I was promising you one thing, and I delivered another, you wouldn't be very happy. And that's precisely what happens. In their vision, they had idolized this image of what was going to happen when the Messiah came. And so they had decided that this vision of what was going to happen was their vision. And when Jesus announced these things for one moment, Jesus became that idolized figure that was going to make it happen until He opened His mouth again. And when He opened His mouth a second time, after perceiving that they were raving, that they were impressed, He says, well, don't you know something? And so he uses what are called aphorisms, or these statements or conventional wisdom that happen to be floating around. And He said, surely you're going to say, doctor, heal yourself and do here what you have done elsewhere in Capernaum. And so immediately we need to kind of reckon, what is that kind of conventional wisdom that's floating around? What does it look like? Well, I have a couple of illustrations I hope will help. You know, Jason White won the Heisman in 2003. And I can't remember, Nathan would know better, but I can't remember when he built his house right down the road here and moved back to town. Now, it's pretty cool that you know, you get your name on the water tower, but he doesn't provide the water. You understand that, right? Jason's not bankrolling Tuttle Water. Yeah. And so when they repainted and all, he didn't give them the money to do that. It was time to, you know, perform some maintenance. But what happens from time to time is when someone who's achieved a great thing moves back to their hometown and they've done something really extraordinary in one place, those who happen to be from here, and some of us who aren't, may have the expectation that now he's going to do some great things for us. He's going to put us on the map. And so there is this expectation that you did some great things over here, but now we really have high expectations. And I've sat in civic meetings where conversations have been had about that sort of thing, where it goes something like this. Well, I bet Jason would do this. This, after all, is his hometown. And the expectation is that because he did so well in Norman, and he made it to New York City, and he's got the statue, that's going to translate coming back to Tuttle, that now all of a sudden Tuttle has a statue. And he will just pull out the checkbook and fund all sorts of things. Because everyone knows Heisman folks are millionaires. And not so quick. So you understand that that takes time for them to start giving money back. I mean, after all, here's the second illustration. Wes Welker was back in town. Did you see that on TV? You know, the Runty Heritage Hall guy who didn't get drafted by anyone but Texas Tech and then made everybody pay for it? Who has been the receiver everybody wanted to have in the NFL? I mean, nobody thought he could endure it because he's just this diminutive little guy, but he has really, really made a name for himself. He's back in town because he donated some money to, wasn't it a middle school? For some football fields, I think, where they could actually practice better. Well, see, that became the expectation, but he didn't do that just after. It took some time, and he came back, and so everybody expects, yeah, Wes is making, he's making millions, so he ought to come back and do something. See? Well, see, that's where we get the idea. That's the aphorism. Do now here in your hometown what we heard you do in Capernaum. It was something that was an expectation. And what that meant was, you're one of us. Surely, it's almost you owe us. And so this is the vision they have of Jesus. Wow, if you're doing things over there because it's our hometown, you're really going to get it done. Now, do you understand how that cheapens the vision and the identity Jesus has chosen for himself? In other words, if Jesus is limited to doing the great things in his hometown, then his self-identity that he is here for all people now has shrunk. And now all people only include those in his hometown. Are you with me? So we take the universal announcement that I come to bring good news to these categories of people. And those in his hometown say, that's us. So do it right here. And that's our expectation. Because we've had this vision of Messiah, and we just want Nazareth on the map. Well, if you do a little reading about Nazareth, there's some who even question its historicity. There's some who think that, like Nathaniel, man, that's not even a place to be from. So Jesus was saying no to their vision for himself when he then went on to say, look, when Elijah was helping a widow in the midst of 3.5 years of drought, he didn't choose an Israelite woman, but instead he went to the widow at Zarephath in Sidon, which actually, if you do your history, that was from the region that were kind of the arch rivals of Israel. Do you get what Jesus just did? Last week, Ron Wortham caught us in the foyer. There were three of us, and he said, I wanted to say there are the three stooges. And he said, but I didn't want to have to identify Curly. And I thought to myself, I just want to be the guy that gets to poke the fingers in the eyes. I don't remember which one that is, you know. But the guy that poked. See, that's what Jesus did. Now, I know Jesus is nice and he would never do things like that. But when the expectation was that this is what Messiah would do in his hometown, and Jesus says, listen, Elijah the prophet didn't even care for all the widows who were suffering in drought, but instead he went to a widow in the rival country and provided for her. Do you get how kind of that would make you a little bit rattled? What are you saying? Are you denying that you're from here? Are you uncaring about what's going on with us? Which forces us all the way back up to the way Jesus is using Isaiah 61. And that we probably ought to come back to it for just a moment and expand the implications. That when we read poor, blind, and oppressed, we have to remember that all those are certainly literal categories. There are people who are poor economically, people who are blind physically, and people who are physically oppressed. Those are realities. But Jesus opens up and expands those possibilities as we follow him in the texts of the Gospels, and we find that some people are poor because of where they're from. Poor then takes on this particular vision, that poor then characterizes people who are dishonored because of some circumstance. In other words, they're not seen as equal human beings. So there have been and are still in our country instances where, because of your ethnic heritage, you are often considered just a little bit less than the rest of us. And as a consequence, the category poor would fit you. Because in some sense, that has set you a little bit below everyone else, dishonored you as being an equal human being, and as a consequence has affected you on a variety of levels, which may or may not include economic poverty. It may be a restriction of privilege and opportunity that's unavailable. See? So the poor is certainly those who are economically poor, but the poor are also those who in that day happen to be the what we have come to understand as the marginalized, those who people kind of disregarded because they just didn't measure up for one reason or another. And we want to limit those and make that economic poverty, physical blindness, and literal oppression so that we can narrowly define Jesus' mission, and so we don't have to embrace all of its possibilities. And yet when we look at Jesus and his teaching and his ministry, he explodes those myths. He explodes those narrow distinctions. And now someone can be poor, but not economically poor. So the woman at the well, who was a Samaritan, who Jesus shouldn't have been talking to, who because of her decisions and circumstance was looked down on by everyone else around her. And it was Jesus who came to release her from the captivity and oppression of that particular way of life. Which we ought to probably take another aside and point out that in Isaiah 58, the word is release. And we've kind of moved and translated release to liberate. But release carries the image of something has been let go from obligation or from consequence or from circumstance. It was like Kimberly called me the other day. They'd paid off a car some years ago, and it came time to sell it. And so they sold the car, and they gave the title, and she got a message back that said, "Hey, there's a lien on this car." And she said, "I didn't know you could put liens on cars." I said, "The minute you bought it and someone financed it, there was a lien on it. In case you defaulted, they could sell it and try to get their money back." She said, "Well, I remember working for that construction company, and we could do that on companies when they refused to pay, but I didn't know someone did it on a car." I said, "It's pretty simple. Call the company who financed the car, give them your VIN number, they'll fax you a lien release, you'll take it down or you'll send it over, and then you're freed, you're released from the weight of that obligation. Now you're free to sell the car." I realize it's not the same. I realize selling a car and a lien doesn't approximate, but we don't talk about release in that way. But if we start talking about someone who's released from the restrictions that have been placed on them by their surroundings because they're either not from here or because their heritage is in question or because of some decision they made, when Jesus said, "I came to announce good news to a group of people who have been dishonored by the system and structures that human beings put in place," that is good news. And it's not limited just by saying, "Go get a job." There are other more insidious ways that people are kept in poverty. Blindness works the same way. It's not just that I wished you and I could witness someone taking some dirt, spitting in it, putting on some blind eyes, and they could see. But we also know that in Jesus' day, even those religious leaders were blind. They were blind to themselves. And so when Jesus declared the religious leaders, the Pharisees, whitewashed tombs, we look at that and go, "Man, that's pretty harsh." But what Jesus really was trying to say to them was, "Listen, pay attention. You are not what you say you are. You need to own who you are. The only way you can be set free, the only way you can realize and experience the prophetic word about the Messiah to come is to own who you are. And so to pretend that you're a little more righteous than you are really only exposes the death that's inside of you. Wow. So Jesus wasn't really being mean. He was really saying, come on, own who you are. Then you understand the value of the declaration, I'm setting you free. But what did Jesus follow it up by saying? Those who are well don't need a physician. So if we continue to believe ourselves that we are well, what Jesus is exposing is something about who we really are. And the beginning point of the good news is the embrace of who we are and the recognition of the identity of Jesus and His mission in the world to set us free, to release us from those restrictions that keep us from being God's people of promise and hope. And so we get Jesus also pointing to Elisha. And there were many, the text says, who had skin diseases, who were leprous in Naaman's day. But Elisha didn't go to all those who were in Israel, but he went to Naaman instead. And Naaman was cleansed of his skin disease, of his leprosy. Now, if you take those two illustrations and you tell them to a group of people who are in the synagogue, who know the stories well, and who now hear them as someone saying, listen, you can't narrow my vision. You can't change my identity. I'm going to live into the call of God, which is to be the one who announces good news. And I'm going to pick up the mission that was foretold by my mother, by Simeon, by Anna, that has already been announced, that this is who I am. I'm going to be that person. And here it is. It's fulfilled today. I'm beginning what has already been announced, and I'm living it out. And then go read the rest of Luke chapter 4 and see the things that Jesus began doing in releasing and setting at liberty those who were oppressed and captive and poor and blind, etc. Now, why get mad about that? Sounds like a great vision, doesn't it? But if I embrace that vision Jesus gives and explodes my own vision of what the Messiah ought to be, He's for me. He's only for us. And that's what was going on in Nazareth. Do for us greater things, better things, more things. And so we can never, as a church, as the people of God, say that God is exclusively operative and working in us. He ought to be working through us for the better expression of declaring the good news to those who need to hear it. In other words, every time we narrow down the scope of who the message is for, we do the same thing they did in Nazareth. That what they couldn't grasp in Jesus is Jesus came to make the message of good news that the Messiah had come a universal message, that is, for every people. And Nazareth wanted it for themselves. And so what happens sometimes in the church is we start looking at passages and think that these kind of circumstances are for us. When Jesus is always prophetically saying, I am the anointed one for everyone. I've got good news for everyone. And so would you then pick up that same mantle? Because here's what we do. We then create for ourselves a group of people who become for us the poor. Now, we don't really realize we're doing that, but anytime we set someone below the possibilities of good news in the kingdom of God, we have made them that poor group that Jesus has come to set free. Every time. We do the same thing. So we create structures and systems and opportunities where people can be neglected and relegated to less than deserving of the love of God. And when we do that, we shrink the mission of Jesus and we challenge His identity. And frankly, I think we make of Him an idol to suit the vision we have of Messiah. When Jesus prophetically always wants to explode that vision and say, I'm here for all people. Now that's a tough one. Because the question then is, how do I do that? Because I know my inclination. If I'm going to own who I am, I know that I'm always inclined to do different. And I just say, remember what Nathan read from 1 Corinthians 13. If I speak with the tongue of men and angels, but have not love, I am nothing but a resounding gong and a clanging cymbal. If I go around talking a good show, but I don't have love, I am nothing. And then he gives all the ways in which love is expressed that challenge prophetically the very way we express love and care to others. And then concludes by saying, now, faith, hope, and love, these three remain. But the greatest of these is, if there is ever a possibility that we could assume and pick up the identity and mission of Jesus for the hope of the world, to declare the good news that in Jesus God is reconciling the world to himself, it will be when we embrace love. For we go and always appeal to that verse as our favorite, for God so loved the world. And then we decide to limit and narrow who that love's for and what it means. And if we are going to be prophetically God's people, we will challenge any time someone says, but God doesn't love them. And so we pick up the way of love. Love never fails. Would you bow your heads and close your eyes with me for a moment? This morning we get to celebrate that love by sharing the bread and the cup around the table. It is a recognition that people of all backgrounds, ethnic geography, social status, structure, everywhere get together around a table. There are no seats higher than another. And so when we partake of those symbols of the body and the blood of Jesus that proclaim, as Paul said, Jesus' death until he comes, we understand that was the expression of God's love for us, that Jesus embodied and embraced all of those ways, habits, practices, sins that we commit toward one another and toward God by reducing others to less than what they can be in Jesus, and then thereby establish patterns that keep them that way. And when we take of that bread and that cup, we have said it won't be that way. Jesus identified himself as the one who declared good news. Release and freedom are in Jesus. And we ought to declare that same message as part of our mission, identified as the people of God who are full of the Spirit, in the power of the Spirit, following the leadership of the Spirit, declaring good news in all of these places, not just our places. And so we do know that the what, the when, and the how is all bound up in Jesus' identity as the Son of Man, his designation. The Son of God, our recognition. Savior, our need. Messiah, the one who fulfills the promise. Good news, because he brings release and freedom and liberty. And for we who fall under the love and grace of God and Jesus, who have given our lives to his way, his work, trusting in him, we carry on that identity in our being and our mission, and that mission in our doing.